You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome to OK Sis Podcast.
Hi, sisters. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Scout.
And we are sisters IRL.
I'm the older one.
Yes, Scout. We know.
We're cultural observers.
And of curious minds.
Get ready for sisterly banter while we chat about fixations, learnings, and personal growth.
We promise it'll be a good time.
As long as you don't get too loud, Mads.
Welcome to the sisterhood.
Hi, sisters. Scout here. And just Scout, because today is this month's installment of mental health chats, and I have quite the episode for you. I brought on Sadie Sutton. She is the host of She Persisted podcast, which I was a guest on. I will link that episode in the show notes so you guys can go listen to me on her podcast. And Sadie and I met a year ago. She invited me to be on her podcast. And as we started chatting, I recognized how special of a woman Sadie is. First of all, she is I'm totally going to fuck this up. I believe 19 years old, she says it in this episode. She is someone who lives with mental illness, has had mental health problems, and actually went into treatment as a teenager in high school. And what attracted me so significantly to her story is not only did she go through treatment so young, but that she did even went through treatment. I think so many times for people with mental illnesses or people that have mental health problems, we aren't aware that there are options for us to go somewhere and get full support that we need. So this is definitely an episode, even if you don't have a mental illness, I thought it was so, so important to talk to someone who is so young. First of all, you guys are going to be so impressed by the way she carries herself and talks about her story, not only being as young as she is, but really to hear how confident and secure and strong she is because she took radical action over her mental health. So I know that most of us listening to this episode don't need to go check in necessarily to a treatment program, but I thought it was so important to share Sadie's story because it shows the proof of what happens when you significantly commit to your mental health, when you significantly commit to uncovering those limiting beliefs, those negative toxic patterns, when you commit to doing the work. So whether or not you are dealing with a mental illness or you are a human being on this beautiful planet navigating the depths and the waters, the valleys and the peaks of your mental health, this episode and Sadie in particular is such proof that when you do the work on yourself, you see insurmountable rewards. So Sadie is someone that I so significantly look up to. Guys, sisters, keep an eye on her. And I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you are interested, go check out Sadie's podcast, She Persisted Podcast. Again, I'll link in the show notes our episode together. And you can follow Sadie on Instagram at She Persisted Podcast. I love you all, sisters, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, beautiful.
Hi. It's good to talk to you again.
I know. Okay, so there's so much that I want to, I suppose, set the sisterhood up as to why you and I are chatting. First, obviously, we're going to have a Scout mental health chat.
Yes.
But you reached out to me, was it last year for me to be on
your
podcast?
It was, I think, almost exactly a year ago, which is crazy.
Okay. And can you tell everybody how old you are?
I just turned 18 in March and graduated high school like last week.
Oh, my God. I have to start with that. Like, not that, you know, if you were my age, which is currently 29, and you came to me with who you were, I would be impressed as is.
Yeah.
But I remember going on your podcast to talk about mental health, and it was, and I was so impressed by you. One, I have never fucking met a high schooler who has taken not only such ownership and control over their mental health, but also has the backing of formal treatment, formal therapeutic models, and knowledge about things like CBT.
Yeah.
And okay, so I was super blown away, and then you reached out to come on OK Sis, and I was like, Sadie, you have to come on my mental health chats. You, I can keep raving. You are phenomenal, and I am so excited to see where you are in 5 years.
Me too.
because you're already on a trek. Okay, but the sisterhood did not come here to listen to me just rave about who you are as a beautiful woman. Can you, real quick, before we get into it, because I really do want to talk about the treatment side of mental health.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about your experience, because your story is such a unique one?
Totally. So when I was thinking about what I was going to kind of boil it down to the bullet points and kind of condense my experience, I think a lot of it goes down to belief systems, which I'm sure you can relate to as well. And so when I was a teenager, whether like 13, 14, middle school, I lived my entire life through the lens that I wasn't deserving of love, I wasn't going to be good enough for my parents, and that I was destined to feel the way that I was feeling forever. And I didn't recognize what I was feeling as depression or anxiety because I didn't enter treatment until a couple months or a year later. But for me, every day was just filled with guilt and shame and loneliness and isolation and all of these things that I thought were normal. And I think that's something that's really unique to adolescent mental health struggles, is that you've already kind of almost forgotten so much of your life. So your emotional experience is amplified. You're not fully developed cognitively, so your emotions are stronger as you're going through puberty. So, like, all of these things are a perfect storm to feel completely overwhelmed and like your life is not going to change. And so I was just navigating the world through these lenses that I wasn't good enough for anyone, I didn't deserve love or care or relationships, and I was going to be depressed forever. And that's a really sad thing for a 13-year-old to think, that the next 60 years of their life was meant to look like their worst day every single day. And so I struggled a lot with depression. That was kind of the core issue for me. And then I had some different presentations of anxiety and OCD and eating disorder stuff. But the root of it was really that depression and those belief systems. And so I struggled for 2 years or so with severe depression before I started doing treatment, which we'll dive into, of course. But it, as a teen, it manifested in so many different ways, whether that was just completely isolating from my parents, my family members, cutting off friendships, struggling with self-harm, suicidal ideation, all of these things which a lot of teenagers don't deal with or aren't feeling these emotions on such a magnitude. And I kept going back to the concept that I hadn't experienced any big traumas. I hadn't gone through any changes when I started to be depressed. And so I was like, there's no reason why this should be happening to me. Like, I'm not even deserving of feeling depressed because nothing's happened. Like, this belief system was just a total mess. And I think it just really speaks to how anyone can be affected by mental health and things like depression. And it's so biological how intensely we feel our emotions and how sensitive we are, because me as a 13-year-old was like, the world is ending. I'm so alone. I'm so depressed forever. And I was living a life that most people are like, okay, that's pretty normal. But for me, I was just so overly sensitive and so in tune to these interactions that I was looking through for evidence that I was not good enough and not deserving.
There's so many things that you said. One, I'm just picturing myself as an 18-year-old stealing vodka from my parents and getting drunk, definitely not speaking the way you are, which is, I think, something that the next generation is really going to start doing, which is talking about their belief system. And something that you said that rings true so much in my life, and when I was that old, you know, I had my first depressive episode at 14, and on paper, with everything, my life was perfect. I was going to private school. I had a loving family. There was no abuse. There was no quote unquote intense trauma, which Dr. Nicole LaPera says that we all experience trauma. Trauma mm-hmm. is on a very, you know, it doesn't have to look like
it's
something
a continuum,
so
totally.
Yeah, something mm-hmm. so shocking. But you said something about not deserving of being depressed. So here you were thinking you weren't deserving of the good things, and then you were also feeling like you weren't being deserving of being depressed.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think so many people with mental health and mental illness experience, is they're like, well, my life is great, I don't need to feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a, I suppose, evidence that in the chemical biological space, sometimes life can be on paper super, super great, yet our internal worlds are totally going crazy. So Let's also, you said like life not changing, destined to live that way forever. That's, I think, that belief system, that belief, I think, is what keeps everybody in the thick of their mental health, their mental health problems, which my mom would always say to me when I was depressed. She's like, it'll go away. But I said, but it'll come back.
Yeah.
And so that was the wrong mindset. And, you know, this too shall pass, that could resonate with you or not. What resonates mostly for me is the poet Rilke's quote, which says, no feeling is final.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in this state.
Yeah.
Clearly you're talking about it now from a very self-aware perspective. What was the awareness there at all? Or was it just this complete buffoonery of I'm fucking depressed?
It was blame. It was blame to my parents for raising me to be the way that I was. I was so young that I hadn't experienced that much of the world. I was like, this must be their fault. I completely believed that the way I was feeling was a direct result of our interactions. And I think that furthered my own depression, because then I would go into these interactions and be like, if they don't react in this exact way, this means they don't love me and they don't care that I'm struggling. And they're not mind readers. Of course, they wouldn't react in that way. And so this cycle's just continued. So it was partially blame. It was just major feelings of being overwhelmed. These emotions are constant. They're so heavy. They take over your entire life to the point where you're not able to function and do anything else. Like, your number one goal is just trying to be stable, get through the day, and be in control of your emotions. So there was no self-awareness. There was no understanding of the belief systems. It was just that I was feeling this terrible thing that must have been someone's fault, not mine, and it would never go away. And those feelings, they add up over time. At first, it was like, okay, I'll live this way for the rest of my life. And it got to the point where it was like, well, I don't want this rest of this life. This is terrible. And so there was no self-awareness there. There was no understanding of the nuances of what goes into one's mental health, or the fact that anyone, including teenagers who are living with their parents and have minimal control, anyone can make changes and truly shift their mental health.
So let's talk about the treatment part of this all, because when I heard your story, just when I was on your podcast, you shared briefly that you went somewhere for treatment.
Yes.
And I want you to talk about that experience, because when you said it, I remember my problem with getting well and better, and the fact that my healing took so many years, is because I kept saying, well, there's nowhere for me to go. You know, you're an alcoholic, you go to rehab.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where to go. There's no place for people like me to just go unless it's this terrible inpatient program. So when you said that your parents sent you somewhere, you know, one, I said a prayer and a blessing and a thanks to your parents for having the foresight to intervene in that level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know someone in my life who is, you know, younger, family member, and I was asked, what should we do with her? And I said, put her somewhere.
Yeah.
Send her to treatment. Mm-hmm. I wish when I was 18 or 19 and my world was being turned upside down that someone said, stop everything and go to treatment. But unfortunately, those treatments for mental health specifically aren't as common. They're not as widespread as places like rehab. So that was why I was so intrigued with your story, also to prove that treatment does work and that it is out there. So can you talk about the decision that either you made or your parents made to go to treatment, and what your experience at that place was? The other day, my cousin looked at me and asked if I got a treatment in my hair. I said no, but I am taking Nutrafol. You see, sisters, I had some shedding issues postpartum when it came to my hair, so I made it my mission to support my hair growth and strengthen my hair. I mean, Mads, you saw my hair last time I was up in LA, and you even complimented me. Which, sisters, you know that when Mads compliments me, it's a big deal.
I do have to give this one to you, Scout. Your hair is looking thick,
strong and beautiful. When it comes to hair thinning, it's complicated. The problem is it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker and stronger hair.
Every morning after I eat breakfast, I take 4 pills and it becomes a seamless addition to my morning routine. But the reason I decided to go with Nutrafol when supporting my hair health is that Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding. Oh, also, Nutrafol makes the best Mother's Day present, especially for new moms. The perfect way to show them that you care about their postpartum support.
Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month's subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OKSIS. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OKAYSIS. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code OKSIS.
So I really liked what you said about how I dropped everything, right? And had I gone on struggling, which who knows if I would have made it to this point if I was still just continuing my life as is, the ability to drop everything and not have long-term consequences kind of gets, like, it decreases as you get older. I went to treatment during my freshman year and was able to completely be on track as far as high school, graduate, get into a good college. And so my life was minimally affected, even though I dropped everything for a year and a half. As you get older and you're working and you're financially independent, like, that becomes a lot more difficult. And so I want to first kind of, like, identify the fact that not everyone can be like, yep, next year and a half of my life is going to be
changed. But I will interject there and say that I think that's a limiting belief that people think, because mm-hmm. I think that if you do get to the age, let's say, of 35 and you have a family and a career and your mental health is debilitating so much and you say to yourself, well, I can't take the year and a half, guess yeah. what? The rest of your life's done. So you either take the year and a half yeah. and get better and figure it out. Mm-hmm. But yes, 100%, it is so much easier for someone who's in yeah. high school to take that time off. Mm-hmm. But if you are listening to this, like, I don't care how long it takes or how many years it sheds off your career, stopping your life to focus on healing will improve the long term yeah. so much more significantly.
And when you're kind of looking at long term treatment, you're in crisis mode. Like, that oh, is yeah. like one of the only options. So it's not like, oh, it would be nice to go and sit on a beach for 6 months and meditate. It's like, you got to do something at this point. Things are falling apart. So I, to preface, before I went to treatment, I tried everything you can imagine locally. I did inpatient hospitalization stays. I did outpatient programs. I did outpatient DBT, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient programs, individual therapy, family therapy, group therapy, you name it, I tried it. Like, we were expending every single resource locally. I was driving down to Stanford 3 times a week for treatment. Like, things were not working in the trajectory that I was heading. I needed more support. I needed to kind of remove myself from my environment so that I could change things myself and then re-enter and be able to cope. And I think that's something that's true for a lot of people. When you're in an environment that you're seeing is invalidating, or these interactions are reinforcing these beliefs, making significant changes to those belief systems or those relationships is really difficult when you're just still in that, stuck in that environment. So I was halfway through my freshman year when I was kind of told that I was going to be going to a residential program. And it was kind of brought to me as, like, there aren't any more options. You can't go back to this old program. You've just been in the hospital with a suicide attempt. This is your 4th hospital stay in 12 months. There's nothing else that we can do. You have to go somewhere. And so my parents, God bless them, they searched for the best program in the country, and they found this program called 3 East at McLean Hospital. And so McLean Hospital is the number one psychiatric hospital in the country. They're a Harvard Medical School affiliated program. They're the forefront of all of the kind of psych research that's going on. And so they have this amazing program for both adolescent girls and boys. It's 2 separate ones where they focus on something called DBT, which stands for dialectical behavioral therapy. And my parents latched onto this because of the clinical studies, especially in adolescents. When you're doing something like talk therapy or you're going to group therapy. You'll see changes, meaningful changes, but with DBT, it's a super intensive by the book treatment where you're learning skills, you're doing group therapy, you're working through these systematic different modules. And so you clinically are going to decrease in levels of depression, suicidal ideation, self-harm urges, and there's overwhelming evidence for that regardless of where you're doing it, what doctors you're working with, and so that's what they loved. It was research-based, there was a success rate, and it wasn't just like, we'll send our kid to this place and we hope it works. It was like, there's evidence here, there's research. And I think that's another thing that people get concerned about when you're pursuing mental health treatment. It's like, well, how do you know this is going to work? And just like the clinical vaccine trials, they do the same thing for mental health treatments. They see if there's evidence that these things work, and they change your levels of depression and anxiety and your presenting symptoms and all of these things. So halfway through my freshman year, I flew across the country. I packed up all my stuff with my parents, and we got to this like giant brick building right outside of Boston. And I remember we got in there, and I was sitting in this room with like 12 clinicians, and they asked me, they were like, do you want to be here? And I was like, no, I don't want to be here. I've been told that this is my only option. I've already done DBT. This isn't going to work. So I have to be here, but I don't want to be here. And for the first time ever in my treatment journey, they looked at me and they said, so this is a voluntary program. All these girls that you see walking around here are here because they want to be here, and they see the wisdom in this treatment. They might emotionally not feel like it might work, but they can understand the rationale, and they can have enough hope for themselves to want to change. And unless you can cultivate that, it's not going to work. We can put you through the motions, we can have you learn these skills, but nothing's going to stick. And so I took the night to think about it. I went back to the hotel room and I watched The Bachelor. And I remember they were like, if you don't go here, your parents can go somewhere else where they'll sign on a line and you can stay for however long. And that's another unique part of adolescent treatment, which we can dive into. But that kind of scared me. I was like, okay, I want to be here. I want to be in control. And I, for the first time in my entire treatment journey, I trusted other individuals enough to help me. And I wanted to get better. I had enough self-love to want a better life for myself, even if I had no idea what that looked like. I was terrified of stumbling blindly toward this idea of not being depressed, but I wanted that life that was out there somewhere that I believed these people could help me get to. And so I was there for 14 weeks, and I did so much skills education and group therapy. My parents were flying from San Francisco to Boston every week to learn their own skills and do group therapy and build a relationship with me. And there was just this complete shift of going in suicidally depressed, struggling with depression and anxiety. I remember I had such a problem with not being able to get out of bed that they would lock my door and be like, you just can't go back in there because you're going to sleep all day. Like I was struggling with everything. And then I left. And for the first time in 2+ years, I wasn't waking up in the morning depressed. I wasn't suicidal. I wasn't having these urges. And so it was a lot of little things. It was making sure I had a routine in place and I was getting up and going places and I was forming these relationships. And rather than having an option like suicide as a back burner, it wasn't going to be there. I made that decision that was no longer going to be something that was ever considered. And so I left after 14 weeks and went to a second program for 14 months, where I continued to kind of stabilize the work that I'd done and really just maintain these skills that I'd built before I re-entered that initial environment of home, which at first was really emotionally traumatic to me because I was so overly sensitized to all of these interactions. Whenever I give recommendations for treatment or people are like, what's helpful, I always go back to that first program because that was what changed everything for me so much. The second program I have mixed feelings about because it's considered to be like part of the troubled teen industry and there's a lot of complex things that go on there, like your custody being signed over and super limited communication and things that I don't think were as helpful to my healing process. But that first program, it changed my life, and that mindset shift that took place, and day after day trying to work towards this life worth living that I was just starting to dream up, that was what changed everything for me.
Oh, there's so much, you know, I think the process that you went through, treatment or not, is universal to healing, right? There's the resistance that you feel, no, I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. No, I don't want to do this. Then there's the thought of, okay, well, I would like a better future, even though leaving depression seems scary and daunting in itself.
That's your comfort space. Like,
that's your
comfort space.
It
might be terrible, but it's familiar. You know what's going to happen, and it's there. It's like your safety blanket. So to go anywhere from there, it could get worse before it gets better. And so that was terrifying.
Yeah, that's really what held me in my bipolar disorder depression so long, was because my body said, okay, well, we got this pain figured out. Like, we know how to do this shit, right? Like, you don't get out of bed, you don't go to school, you drop out of everything. We know how to do this. But the pain to get better, that's a different type of pain that we in here don't know about. And so as with everything in life, when you leave a comfort zone for something else, it's difficult. And though it's an interesting picture to paint that leaving your depression to heal can be painful as well, and that your ego would want to keep you in the comfort zone of the original pain, even though the original pain is going to ruin you. It's a very, it's amazing what the mind will do to keep you in a pattern that they recognize and can predict. And then you said, you know, once you even thought of a better future that you wanted, even though you acknowledged that that was painful to get out of that comfort zone, you mentioned the idea of hope, which is something that I always talk about. It's the moment I got better. When my husband told me, you guys have heard this 25 million times, I will repeat it again. He looked at me 2 months into dating and he said, I don't care if you're depressed. If you're depressed and hopeful, I will be in this relationship. If you are depressed and hopeless, I won't be here. And so just that infusion of hope, I didn't change anything. I didn't change my rituals, anything like that. But that infusion of hope allowed me to think about a better way. And then there's the aspect of surrender, that this moment that you get to in life where you realize I've been in the driver's seat for this long and it's not working. So I have to humble myself and put my ego aside to recognize that maybe other people know what they're talking about.
And that's terrifying. I remember before I even got to treatment, it was the first time I was hospitalized. I went to the pediatrician's office. I was 13 at this point, and they told me to go directly to the emergency room and that I was going to spend some time there because I was just so depressed. I wasn't talking. I was just, I couldn't put any words to what I was experiencing because these feelings were so overwhelming. And I remember I got there and the idea of having a diagnosis of depression or saying that I needed help meant that it was real. It couldn't just be compartmentalized and like, oh, this might be a problem, but not really. When you let people in, it means that it's not going away. It's a real challenge, and it's such a challenge that you can't deal with it yourself. And that's a terrifying thing to grapple with. And people know what they're doing. Like you said, these are people that have gone to school for decades to support you and use evidence-based treatments and compassion and help you through this and be in your corner, even though you're the one fighting the battle. And so it's terrifying, but it's downhill from that point of first asking for help and accepting that it's bigger than you, because you have more individuals on your side rooting for you and you have a whole village that can pull from their experiences and knowledge to help you in your treatment.
Your experience with treatment, I think, was a lot different than my experience with the treatment that I had in many ways, which was probably because it was not concentrated. It was all over the place. It was random. It was outpatient programs. One, you know, they locked me up once. It was really, I was trying to fumble through, which I think is why it took me so many years to figure it out. But yeah, you know, for me, I think a lot of the times, which is probably my ego coming through and wanting to protect myself from getting help, a lot of the times I would look at the people and be like, how do you know? How do you know what you're talking about? You read it in a textbook? Like, have you lived with this before? And and that was me just questioning authority, which I always do, which is probably a weakness of mine at that point. But the reason I wanted you to tell your story is because it's a story that I've never heard. I've never met anybody with a mental health problem that I can relate to and felt that I can see myself so much in your story. And know that there was a place where you went to that young, which is so remarkable in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about where you're at today, because obviously the young lady that is standing in front of me or is zooming in front of me is very different from the other one, that the younger Sadie that was really struggling and feeling that intense overwhelm. When you healed and when you came back into life, into your home, your house, how old were you at that point?
I was like 16 and a half. I was a week out of starting junior year.
Okay, so you were 16 and a half. You said 18 now. You're 18. So that rate of healing is so accelerated. So I want to talk about what today looks like for you. Because as someone with a mental illness, there's always times for me, which I feel like I did my most healing within the last year and a half to really be strong. There's moments when the overwhelming feeling of depression, anxiety does come over me, and I have to remind myself of who I am, what I've learned, where my strength is, where my tools are, etc. So I think that sometimes there's this misconception, unless this is totally not your experience, and please correct me if I'm wrong with this. There's a misconception that sometimes when you heal from your mental illness, that your mental health journey is then smooth sailing, when really for me, it's a constant upkeep and management. It's a constant prioritizing myself. It's constantly checking in with my beliefs. What are my thought patterns saying? Am I meditating? Am I taking time for myself? So what does your mental health look like today? And what happens if you do feel a pang of depression?
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Yeah, I think like everything in life, it's a muscle that you're building. Those first days, every single morning, I was waking up and telling myself, okay, suicide is not an option for today. I am going to get out of bed and I'm going to go to this therapy group. And it was overwhelming feelings of still depression and anxiety and doing the opposite of what my emotions were telling me to do and leaning on others intensively for support. I remember at Residential, which was the program in Boston, I loved therapy so much. Just like talking about what I was going through, having that person, my therapist would like reinforce me for getting out of bed by giving me like 5 therapy sessions a week. Like no one else was volunteering for this, but like just being able to lean on people for support, which I hadn't done before, was a game changer. So early days, it's a struggle. Every single moment, you're just pushing yourself to do what your emotions are telling you not to do. And I think with time, it gets a lot easier. That idea of, for me, it was suicide being on the back burner. It's just so far away now that I'm no longer every morning waking up and saying, this is not an option. And so it's time, it's building a muscle. And I completely do agree with you that I still feel moments of depression and that mental health is all about maintaining things. And I remember in treatment, someone told me that if you're not progressing, you're digressing. And I think that's so true, because if you're not working towards a betterment of your mental health, it's really easy to revert back to these old patterns that, I don't know about you, but served me. Well, I was super ineffective with self-harming and suicidal ideation and being in and out of the hospital. That got me connection and care and love from my parents and people showing concern. So there's a reason why we develop.
Oh yeah, there we go. That's
what it is. We
develop
these behaviors for a reason.
And that was me. That was me. I got so much fucking attention for being depressed.
My doctors got to a point where they were like, you cannot come visit her in the hospital. Like this, she's just going to keep coming back here. And
dude, so, Sadie, real quick. When I was an inpatient, my dad brought me like high-end meals. Every single meal.
Me too. They would come and bring me takeout for every single meal.
I got sushi.
I had groceries in the fridge. The people were like, who is this girl? Like, this is not what this is about. I had like Girl Scout cookies brought in. I had my teachers visiting me. My friend came. My siblings came to visit. It was a disaster. Like, that behavior was like, I loved that. That was like, this is care. This is concern. People can see what I'm feeling is real. So yeah, going back to, we all experience our mental health moments. We have to continue to move in the direction that we want to, even though that's not always clear. And so for me now, I go back to the basic things that I worked on in residential. And that was, first of all, sleep. Like that was such a big problem for me. I was constantly struggling with insomnia. For me, I connected going to sleep with waking up and feeling depressed. So if I just avoided going to sleep, I didn't have to wake up and feel that feeling of living this life that I hated so much. And so I avoided it. I would go like days without sleeping. I am a very emotionally avoidant person. And so that was something that I just thrived on, was just not sleeping. And it was terrible. It made my mental health so much worse. And so for me, sleep is number one. I'm making sure that I'm getting enough sleep. I'm keeping it consistent. The other things are connection, having relationships that fuel me, even if sometimes my relationships with my parents, I'm like, this is like not helping me. Like, this is really making me feel really angry or alone. And so I'll lean more on my friends. And so having that idea of a family that you've cultivated for yourself and relationships that make you feel good, regardless of who those people are, having things to do, whether that's school or work or the podcast, which I'm really passionate about, is huge. Having that sense of mastery and a purpose. And then just really every single day doing things that bring me joy and accumulating those positives, so that when I do have those moments of lows, it's not that I can go back to the headspace of everything sucks, I have nothing going for me, because I have all of these amazing things that I've accumulated and built for myself. And so the last thing that I'll mention as far as feeling moments of depression, the huge shift that's taken place with this ability to cope and be effective is that when I feel depressed, it's no longer going to be a 6-month period until I feel anything different. I can go to sleep that night and wake up the morning and feel okay. So I, like you said, talking about impermanence, the quote that I lean on is life is impermanent and that impermanence will be on your side. These emotions don't last, and that's so much more true when you're working towards this goal of having a healthy, balanced form of mental health. So that depression might be there and it's serving a purpose. It's kind of kicking you in the butt for whatever's not going well in your life, but it's not going to last. And when you've gotten good at creating ways in your life that bring you joy and improve your mental health, the period that it lasts for is a lot less significant than it is when you have nothing that you've built for yourself.
Can you talk like this to your friends, or are they just confused?
It's funny. It's like I talk to my parents one way, I talk to my friends one way, the podcast is a whole other world. It's like, I think if I talked to any of my friends and I was like, yes, like all of these different belief systems, they'd be like, no, this is too serious, this is too much. But I love it. I'm so passionate about it. And so that's why I love doing the podcast, is because I can just kind of geek out on all that kind of stuff and have these amazing discussions. But no, it's definitely a compartmentalized part that I wouldn't push on everyone, because I know that's not why I build those relationships. I now build my friendships to build me up and laugh with and have a shoulder to cry on, and not to be my therapist and have these intense mental health discussions like I maybe would have in the past.
The boundaries, the wisdom, the understanding that different relationships are for different things, that you can't dump this kind of conversation on your best friend the same way you can't dump the relationship you have with your best friend and your podcast and that kind of different, I suppose, facets of yourself. What, you know, it's obviously very emotional with my parents when they see something that I do that's successful, or they recognize and look back at where I used to be and see where I am now, because there were so many times when my dad would just cry because he didn't know if I was ever going to make something of myself, if I was ever going to be safe in my emotions, etc. You know, especially my husband being in a relationship while going through a mental illness is a whole other intense ballgame. So seeing you now, what do your parents think, feel, and say?
So it's different emotions for sure. There's so much pride, 100%, for what I've done and the shifts that I've made. My mom, she, like, when I first started the podcast, she would not go within like a 6-mile radius of it. She wouldn't listen to it. She wouldn't talk about it. It was like emotionally traumatic for her to relive these moments, because it just came with so much pain and sadness to see your kids suffering and not know how to help them. Now she'll listen to the podcast sometimes and she'll talk about it, which is fun. My dad was the one that suggested the podcast. And when I was first at that program in Boston, this was so bad. He was like, Sadie, you've got to start a podcast. Like, think about how powerful this story will be. Like, so many people struggle with mental health. I'll send you a recorder. It'll be great. And the doctors were like, sir, this is totally against HIPAA. She cannot have a recording device in this mental hospital. And he was like, but it's for a podcast. And I was like, no. So like a year later, I was like, okay, maybe he's on to something. But he's always been very supportive. And I think for me, like with that relationship with them, there's still challenges. And I still struggle with the idea that I'll never be good enough. And so while there's all of these things where I'm like, this is crazy that 4 years ago I was in and out of the hospital, or being, I was still at a residential program 3 years ago. There's still moments where they're like, Sadie, like, come on. And I'm like, so there's balance in everything. And so with school, they're like, come on, like, let's get these grades up. Let's go. And there's like, this is really amazing. And this is really cool. And when I had my high school graduation last week, my mom was like, this wasn't really that exciting because I feel like you're already doing so many things that are beyond a high schooler. Like, we're excited for you to graduate college because that feels like what you're already doing with the podcast and all of these different things. You're so into your passions and working on these things that this is just like you're getting the diploma for the purpose of it. It's not like this is what I was working towards. But yeah.
Okay, so before we wrap up, I would love you to give one tip to somebody who might be listening, who is struggling. What's something that you would say to them, something you would encourage them? It could be a positive affirmation. It could be an action tool. It could be a mindset shift. What's one thing that's really on your heart when you hear about someone who is suffering with their mental health that you would love to guide them with?
Yeah, there are so many different things. I will say to educate yourself on what your life can look like. We get really stuck in our own heads and believe that our emotional experiences rule everything. Like, how I am feeling must be the only way that life can exist, and that is so not true. If I had taken the time to kind of get out of my own head and be like, I can read these books about how I can shift my mindset and shift my behaviors and create these routines. And that was another reason why I started the podcast, because I didn't hear a lot of teenagers being like, I did this myself and I got better. And so I wanted to create that narrative. But if you can educate yourself on what your life can look like, not depressed or not anxious or not struggling, I think that's extremely powerful. It's motivating. You have something to work towards and you get out of your own headspace of this is what my life looks like and I'm confined here and things aren't going to change. And so it's a small shift to make. Maybe it's being on Pinterest, it's listening to podcasts, it's reading books, but it's huge. And it gives you that hope that you were talking about. It gives you something to work towards. And I really do believe that your thoughts, your beliefs, and your behaviors will change as a result as you're working towards those things.
You're amazing. I could truly rave about you for forever. And just listening to you talk, I really am in such total awe of how much radical responsibility you've taken over your emotional landscape, over the cards you've been dealt, and then not only taken that kind of personal power into your own hands over your own life, but to then move forward, start a podcast, and help other people through it is so admirable. And I look up to you. I relate to you so much. Can you please let everybody know, sisters, you should definitely go consume all things Sadie. Can you let them know about your podcast and where to follow you?
Of course. So my podcast is called She Persisted. And you can find all of the links for everything at shepersistedpodcast.com. But to give you some more details, my Instagram is at shepersistedpodcast. My TikTok is the same handle. And you can listen everywhere. You can listen on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, all the places. And you can listen to Scout on my podcast as well.
Yay. I'll have to link that episode in the show notes. Everyone can go hear me on your podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, love. And you can find me, sisters, at Scout Sobel. And I was going to plug Mads, but she's not on this fucking episode. So I'm just going to plug myself. Love you, sisters, and have a beautiful day.
Do you ever feel like you're struggling through motherhood? You're not alone. I'm Erica Jossa, host of the Momwell podcast, therapist and mom of three. Join me each Wednesday as I sit down with guests, including psychologists, pediatricians, psychiatrists, fertility specialists, lactation consultants, and more to unravel the myths of motherhood. With expert advice, practical tips, self-love, and some coping skills to help you along the way, you can become the mother you want to be. Listen to the Momwell podcast at momwell.com/listen or on your favorite podcast platform.